chemical engineering at the University of Manchester in the UK. She originally is from Bosnia and Herzegovina. She did her undergraduate degree in chemical engineering at the University of Tuzla, and then went to England where she did her PhD. And it was a very unique thesis entitled Environmental Systems Analysis, and it was unique in the sense it was probably one of the first applications of linear programming to life cycle analysis. She was at the University of Surrey for about 13 years after that, then moved to the University of Manchester, where she has a truly impressive program in sustainability. It's actually sustainable industrial systems, so it's actually, aside from basic research, also very strong links with industry. Companies like Procter & Gamble, Kraft Foods, Whirlpool, and some of the topics that she has been working on include sustainable production and consumption, life cycle sustainability assessment, also with carbon footprint in corporate sustainability. She has actually written, a good number of papers. She has over 11,000 Google Scholar citations. She's also editor-in-chief of a relatively recent journal entitled Sustainable Production and Consumption. And in recognition to all her work, she has received a number of awards. Let me just mention two major ones of them. In 2010, from the Institution of Chemical Engineers in the UK, she received the Outstanding Achievement Award in Chemical and Process Engineering. And in 2011, she received the GlaxoSmithKline Innovation Prize. Also, in recognition to her contributions, she was elected Fellow of the Royal Academy of Engineering. So today, we now have her give us a presentation about sustainability in supply chains and circular economy. So, Adisa, it's all yours. Can you share your screen so we can see your slides, Adisa?
Yes, indeed. I can do that.
Right.
Can you see that?
Yeah, now we can see your screen.
Thank you very much, Ignacio, for your kind introduction. Just before I start, can I just ask if everybody else sees this little window that I see, says LS on it?
LS?
No. No, we don't see it.
No, but
okay, you don't see it. Okay.
Yeah. If you just click on your slides, so we'll go over. We can see at least your slide. That's the important thing. All right?
You can see the slides.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. Thank you also, everybody, for joining us today. I plan to talk for probably, 35 to 40 minutes, and then after that I hope we can have some interesting discussion. So the topic of my talk is sustainable supply chains in a circular economy, and for those who don't have access to WebEx, I'm just going to say every time next slide so that you know that I've moved on, because you should have my presentation. But unfortunately, I can't move it down. Ah, that's an interesting issue. Ah, there we are. So, next slide, which says overview. So I'm going to start with a very brief introduction in terms of what I mean by a sustainable supply chain and what is understood as a circular economy. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the need for systems approach and life cycle thinking. And the majority of my talk will in fact focus to the key issue, does circularity necessarily mean sustainability? And I'm going to illustrate that question or attempt to answer it through four illustrative examples. One of those is going to be in the area of food waste, another one in the area of energy-using appliances, and the last two examples will be related to drinks and food packaging. Now, these examples may not be relevant to your particular activity or to your particular organization, but I hope that they will be illustrative enough that you could see how that might be applicable to your supply chains or to your research in case you are a researcher. And then I'm going to draw some conclusions, and hopefully we'll have some Q&A after that. So let me start with the basic definitions. So there is a lot of talk about circular economy here in Europe, and I presume also in the States. But forgive me, I'm a little bit less familiar with the debate in the States. So inevitably, I will be coming from the position of a person who lives in Europe, and particularly in the UK. The definition that is most widely used, at least in Europe, is the one that was put together by Ellen MacArthur Foundation, and it says that a circular economy must be regenerative and restorative by design. We should keep products and resources in use as long as possible. We should also extract the maximum value while in use, and we should recover and regenerate products and resources at the end of their life. So to me, this all sounds reasonable and good and potentially sustainable. And this is what the Ellen MacArthur Foundation tried to illustrate in this diagram. So I'm now looking at the slide titled Circular Economy. And you can see, if you kind of look back a little at this diagram, that it looks like a butterfly, and it is referred to as a butterfly diagram. So down the spine of that butterfly, you can see various life cycle stages of a product or a system, starting with manufacturing, providing the service, and eventually recovering energy and landfill. And to the left of the diagram, we have the regenerative part of a circular economy, which is all about following the biological cycle. So we should extract biochemical feedstocks, we should use anaerobic digestion or composting to recover energy and resources, and so on. And on the right-hand side of the diagram, we have the restorative part of the circular economy, which involves activities such as maintenance of products rather than throwing them away, then their reuse, refurbishment or remanufacture, and eventually recycle. So the postulate is that if we are able to follow these steps, we might become truly circular and eventually also sustainable. Now, because today I'm focusing on on sustainable supply chains, and I'm now on the next slide, which is titled Sustainable Supply Chain, we also need to understand what we mean by a sustainable supply chain. And this is my own paraphrasing of the standard definition of sustainable development. So a sustainable supply chain must be economically viable, otherwise it's not going to exist. It also must be environmentally benign and socially beneficial. And our real challenge is to integrate all these three components of sustainability and see how we can run supply chains according to these definition. Of course, in many cases, it will involve some trade-offs, but this is the whole point of understanding how these trade-offs work and what they actually lead to. So on to the next slide, which says systems approach and life cycle thinking. Now, I want to argue that if we want to design truly sustainable supply chains and we want to become truly circular, it is absolutely essential that we understand the whole system that we are trying to design or redesign, and that we take a life cycle approach to it. Excuse me, may I just ask the person who is typing just to mute themselves, because we can hear you over and it might be distracting.
Yeah, okay, no, you're right there. So everybody, please mute your phones, because we are hearing background noise, somebody typing, as Adisa has mentioned. Okay, so please mute your phones. So Adisa, please continue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So what does taking a systems approach and applying life cycle thinking to a supply chain mean? Well, this is what I've tried to illustrate in this particular diagram. So for us to be able to produce a product or deliver a service, obviously we have to use raw materials and manipulate them, manufacture the product. Those raw materials have to have come from somewhere, so we have to dig them out of the ground, refine them, transport them, and so on. And then eventually, when that product or service has reached the end of its life, we have to manage it somehow. So typically, products will be collected at the end of their lifetime. Maybe some of that will be recycled, and still a lot of that will end up in a landfill. We may try to recover energy and so on. Now, in all of these life cycle stages or parts of the supply chain, we will be drawing on the environmental resources, which are shown here on the left, top left as inputs. We will be incurring economic costs, but also various social impacts. On the output side of this very large system, we will be generating various environmental impacts, but also various socioeconomic benefits. So only if we are able to understand these fully integrated systems on a life cycle basis and consider all the inputs and outputs, would we be able actually to understand what a sustainable supply chain means and how we could address various hotspots within those sustainable within those supply chains, whether those hotspots be environmental, economic, or social. And for the rest of the talk, I'm going to be applying this systems approach and life cycle thinking within the context of a circular economy, to see how circularity can be translated into designing more sustainable supply chains, but also whether circularity actually always means that something is more sustainable. So moving on to the next slide, which is titled Sustainable Supply Chain in a Circular Economy. And this is a slide that I showed you earlier on, which shows the principles of the circular economy. I'm going to start from the bottom of that slide and talk about the recovery and regeneration of products and resources at the end of life. And I'm going to show you this butterfly diagram again on the next slide, which now shows in red circle or shape which part of that butterfly diagram we are looking at. So we are looking at that biological part of the circular economy and how we could possibly extract value from end-of-life products through a biological cycle. And to do that, on the next slide, I'm going to introduce my first illustrative example, which is related to food waste. And the question that I'm going to ask here is, should we digest it, compost it, burn it, or simply bury it in a landfill? And I just want to put this in the context of a UK situation, where we generate a lot of food waste, like many developed countries. So annually we generate about 7.3 million tons of household food waste, of which almost 5 million tons is managed. And how is it managed is shown in the next slide, which is titled Resource Recovery from Food Waste. So it's managed in four different ways. A lot of that is still incinerated and landfilled, as you can see at the bottom of this block diagram. But increasingly, we are also anaerobically digesting that food waste, and we are also composting it. And this is typically done at the industrial scale through in-vessel composting. Now, each of these methods, waste treatment methods, is recovering various resources, and therefore it qualifies, by the definition of a circular economy, as a biological part of the cycle. So anaerobic digestion recovers electricity, it can recover heat as well, but we don't do it in the UK, and it also requires recovers fertilizers, replacing chemical fertilizers. In-vessel composting produces compost, which again replaces chemical fertilizers. Incineration can generate both electricity and heat. Here we are only focusing on electricity. And finally, all landfills now have to recover a landfill gas, and that is typically turned into electricity. So if we now apply systems thinking and the life cycle approach and estimate the environmental impact of each of these four waste treatment methods, what do we get? So this is shown on the next slide, which is titled Environmental Impacts per Ton. And this slide shows on the x-axis several environmental impacts that we typically estimate in life cycle assessment. And then it shows the total impact of each treatment method. So on the left, the first impact that I'm showing is the carbon footprint, in other words, greenhouse gas emissions on a life cycle basis. And what we can see is that anaerobic digestion is the best option. It has negative carbon emissions, and this is largely due to the credits for recovering electricity from that system and displacing the UK grid electricity. The next best option is incineration, which is also slightly net negative on carbon emissions, again because of the recovery of electricity. But then we can see that in-vessel composting has a much higher carbon emissions, and landfill is the worst option. We also see that anaerobic digestion is the best option for human and marine ecotoxicity. But unfortunately, anaerobic digestion has much higher acidification and particulates, emissions of particulates, than incineration or landfill. And the same applies to in-vessel composting. So now what we are seeing here is that while for the carbon footprint, for example, anaerobic digestion as a circular economy method is very good, but it's very bad for two of the other impacts, such as acidification and particulate emissions. And then we also see that in-vessel composting, in fact, is the worst option for almost all of the impacts. So again, in-vessel composting is one of the methods specifically recommended to be implemented in a circular economy. So if I go to the next slide, and summarize the findings from this illustrative example. What I've just said is that in-vessel composting is the worst option. In this case, we clearly see that circular does not translate into sustainable. So we have to be quite careful when we push for something that looks circular but may not be environmentally or even economically sustainable. Of course, I've only here shown you an example that relates to the environmental sustainability, but one needs to understand the economic implications and social implications as well. unfortunately, no time for that today. We've seen that the anaerobic digestion is the best option for the carbon footprint and most other impacts, but it has much higher acidification and particulates. And this is really largely related to the emissions from the digestate, which is being spread onto the land instead of chemical fertilizers. If we then look take a step back and say, well, instead of treating all this waste and generating all this food waste, we would achieve much greater benefits through waste prevention. In fact, our estimates show that the environmental impacts would decrease by several orders of magnitude, which would also be translated through economic and social gains. And in fact, this is no-brainer. And yet, in a circular economy, we focus on the kind of end of life rather than what we should do before we even get there. And this has been recognized particularly in terms of the food systems, that we have to waste less of food. So all of these results in much more detail are available in the paper, which is listed at the bottom of this and the previous slides, and I have a list of references for your perusal later on. Now, let me move on to the next illustrative example, and I'm now showing again the slide which lists the principles of the circular economy, and I'm going to focus on the first principle, which says that circular economy should be regenerative and restorative by design. And to illustrate this point, So this is on the kind of right-hand side of that butterfly diagram, if you remember that. And to illustrate this example, I'm going to focus on something that we are all familiar with and have at home, and that is vacuum cleaners. So this is my example related to energy-using devices or appliances. Now, again, looking at the EU situation, the European Union situation, there are 200 million vacuum cleaners in use currently in the EU, 28 countries. And this is growing annually with 45 million appliances sold annually. So to me, that is a staggering number of vacuum cleaners. So if you look at the environmental impact of manufacturing and using these vacuum cleaners in the 28 of the European EU countries, this is what we get. I'm now looking at the slide which is titled Annual Impacts in the EU, and I'm showing just a selection of life cycle environmental impacts, first the carbon footprint, then the resource depletion, acidification, and so on, and all these impacts are expressed per year. So, for example, we see that producing and using vacuum cleaners generates about 11 million tons of CO2 equivalent per year, and so on. These numbers on their own, of course, don't tell us much, but it's still illustrative that these figures are rather large. So if I now move on to the next slide, which is titled Eco-Design and Improving Energy Efficiency. Now, the background to this is that the European Commission issued an Eco-Design Directive specifically for vacuum cleaners, which mandates that all the vacuum cleaners must improve their efficiency to a certain extent, which in practice meant that high energy-consuming vacuum cleaners are banned, and all manufacturers then had to design install new motors within the vacuum cleaners which have a lower energy consumption. So looking just at that change, at the lower power of vacuum cleaners, and again carrying out life cycle assessment to estimate the environmental impact, this is what we get on this slide. So here I'm comparing the impacts that I've just shown you in the previous slide without this eco-design improvement in terms of energy efficiency. This is shown in yellow bars. And then next to it is how much the environmental impacts have reduced by simply reducing the amount of energy they consume. And you see it's almost half across all the impacts. So that's all good, and it's worked. Well, the only question is whether the vacuum cleaners can still do their job because their motors are now too weak is another question. But environmentally, it has worked. So if we now go on to the next slide, and this is something that the European Commission is thinking about. So now moving on from the energy efficiency and thinking about the circular economy, we need to think about material efficiency as well. And I don't know if you've ever been that bored so that you wanted to dismantle a vacuum cleaner, but we have, and this is what we have found. This slide, which is titled Eco-Design Improving Material Efficiency, shows what happens if you start from a vacuum cleaner at the top left corner and dismantle it. These are all the parts that you get. And you can already see that there are quite a few of them. But specifically, next slide, if you count all the pieces available in a vacuum cleaner, we found that there are 150 of them. Pieces that were theoretically not required, 41. Number of task repetitions to dismantle the vacuum cleaner went to 313. And the number of tool manipulations to do that, 116. And effectively, that meant that the number of non-value-added tasks was in excess of 100, which meant that all of these tasks were a waste of time in terms of helping you to dismantle a vacuum cleaner. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because if we are serious about the circular economy, we need to design the product for the ease of disassembly. And this isn't the case. So on to the next slide. Even if we look at the number of different types of material available in a typical vacuum cleaner, we find that there are 15 types of materials. Largely plastics, about 8 types of plastic, then the 3 types of metals, and so on and so on. And this, of course, doesn't help either, because even if you manage to dismantle it for circularity, then all of these materials need to be separated out and so on. So how do we improve circularity of domestic appliances, in this case a vacuum cleaner? On the next slide, which is titled Eco-Design Improving Circularity, we have several indices or indicators which show how they should change if we want to make appliances more circular. So obviously we need to reduce the number of painted surfaces because that reduces their circularity, and currently there are about 15% of them. We need to increase the recyclability. We need to increase the number of parts with labels, because if we don't know what materials they are, well, how can we recycle them at all? We need to increase the same material joints so that when you are joining two parts, those materials are also the same, and also to increase number of reversible joints so that you can dismantle it easier. But of course, this is all much easier said than done, and many companies are finding it difficult to translate that into practice. But that is not to say that that's impossible. So on to the next slide, which is titled Circular Economy in Practice for Vacuum Cleaners, I'm showing various examples that actually are already happening in terms of circularity. So one example is Miele, which produces very long-lasting products, vacuum cleaners, over 20 years, And that is one of the issues with these appliances and various other electronic products, that they're not durable enough, and we want to change them. Dyson have worked on reducing the size of their vacuum cleaner and making it more recyclable. They have take-back systems in place, and they have second-hand products as well, which they are selling. Cambridge Consultants, for example, use sustainable materials. So you see here very elegant vacuum cleaner with the wood parts. They are easily replaceable components and so on. One that I find particularly interesting is the one by Vax. So if you see that the top picture there shows a little box. Well, this is how your vacuum cleaner arrives. It's actually its box, and it's which is packaged. And then when you open that box, it becomes a vacuum cleaner, and you assemble it yourself. So it's a little bit of engineering in practice. And then finally, Electrolux are using waste plastics from the sea to make these vacuum cleaners in very vivid colors. So these examples show that circularity is possible, but of course it's still very difficult to do it. It's still very costly, and these are niche applications. So I'm going to move into the next example, which is related to the principle of keeping products in use as long as possible. And for that, I'm going to use an example of fizzy drinks packaging. And the question here is, should we reuse or recycle drinks packaging? Again, this is placed in the context of a circular economy. And again, if you allow me, I'll place this in the context of the UK. So the fizzy drinks sector in the UK emits about 1.5 million CO2 equivalent per year, if we just focus on the global warming potential. And that represents about 13% of greenhouse gas emissions from the whole food and drink sector. So it's quite significant. So moving on to the next slide, let's just focus on the carbon footprint of fizzy drinks for the moment. And this graph compares fizzy drinks packaged in different bottles, and these are in different packaging. And this packaging is actually what you find in the UK market. So we have glass bottles and aluminium cans, PET bottles of different sizes. And what we can see is that the glass bottles, or rather the fizzy drinks packaged in glass bottles, have the highest carbon footprint, about 555 grams of CO2 equivalent per liter of fizzy drink. Then come the aluminium cans and PET bottles of half a liter. And then the best option is a 2-liter PET bottle. This is all per liter of drink, of course. Now, if we just separate out packaging and forget about the drink, because the drink is really water, a bit of sugar, and some flavoring, we see that the majority of the carbon footprint is indeed related to the packaging. And again, in the same order as I've listed them earlier. So the glass bottle is typically 35% recycled, aluminium cans about just under 50%, PET bottles just under a quarter. So we have a clear ordering or ranking of the fizzy drink packaging here. So the next question is, should we, for example, reuse glass bottles, or should we just recycle them? And when we looked at the carbon footprint of those two activities, so first reusing glass bottles on the next slide, we see that the benefits in terms of the carbon footprint kind of start to fizzle out until you've reused it three or four times. It tends to plateau. And that's because the environmental costs of having to wash and sterilize and collect, etc., kind of countered by not having to produce virgin glass bottles. So what does that mean in terms of now comparing reused glass bottles with the other packaging? So on the next slide, I'm showing the same results I showed earlier on in terms of the fizzy drinks with different packaging. And we see that if we use a glass bottle about four times, the impact's more than half. And if we use it, reuse it 25 times, which is pushing it really, the impact goes still slightly lower. But then what does it mean in comparison to the other packaging? So using glass bottle four times means that it becomes a better choice than the small PET bottle. And reusing it 25 times, it just becomes comparable to a 2-liter PET bottle. So we see clearly here that PET bottle, particularly larger bottle, has an advantage over glass, despite all the debates that we are having about plastics and how we should ban it. I don't know if the same discussion is going on in the US, but in Europe this is the topic number one at the moment. Now, one could say, okay, but you've now reused the glass bottles. What about increasing the recycling of the PET bottles? And if we just focus on a half a liter bottle and forget the large one, so here are the carbon footprint results for the original PET bottle, which is only 24% recycled. And the other two bars refer to much higher recycling, 40% and 60% with the rest landfilled. We see that we can achieve further benefits there, and obviously the 60% one is almost half the impact of the 24% one recycled bottle. So again, to compare them all on the same graph, next slide. So here we have the reused glass bottle four times. This is now still higher carbon footprint than if we were to increase the recycling of the PET bottle. And if we reuse the glass bottle 25 times, then that is comparable to the recycling of 60% of half a liter of PET bottle. So the argument could go that if we increase the recycling of plastic bottles, we would achieve greater benefits than if we were to reuse glass bottles. And mind you, it's not possible to reuse a glass bottle 25 times because they chip after about 5 or 6 times. So, in summary, on the next slide, it pays to reuse glass bottles, but the benefits fizzle out beyond 3 to 4 times. Reusing glass 7 times is comparable to recycling 40% of plastic bottles. I didn't mention that earlier, so this is new information. And then finally, a larger plastic packaging is still better than glass used 25 times. So this completes this illustrative example, and I'm now going to move to the final illustrative example. And this relates to the debate that we are having here, as I mentioned earlier on, that single-use plastics should be banned, and there is some legislation being prepared to make that a law. So I'm going to ask the question here, should we ban single-use plastics or maybe not? Let's have a look. I'm using an example of food containers. Again, something that most of us will be familiar with. And I'm going to compare single-use food containers with reusable food containers. So a lot of people eat out, and they take takeaway food. And that takeaway food comes in typically 3 types of containers, at least in Europe. Plastic containers, extruded polystyrene containers, or aluminium containers with a cardboard top, all shown in this slide here. there are between 500 and 850 million of these units used and disposed in the EU. This is an estimate that that we made in our research. So an alternative to that is, of course, Tupperware. So we can instead use a reusable plastic container, and these days you can actually take your container to many outlets in Europe and they will fill your container with the food rather than giving you their own. So we are going to compare these containers on the environmental impacts again, taking a life cycle approach. Before that, just to mention that the waste management of these different materials varies. So, for example, polypropylene is only 11% recycled, and much of that is then incinerated and landfilled. The aluminium, about half is recycled and half landfilled. And for the extruded polystyrene, we don't have any recycling, and half is incinerated or landfilled. So, this slide, titled Life Cycle Impacts of Single-Use Containers, compares those three, extruded polystyrene, aluminium, and polypropylene, for a number of environmental impacts, carbon footprint, resource depletion, acidification, and so on. And what we can see is that the extruded polystyrene has the lowest impacts across all the categories that we have considered. And this ranges from, on the next slide, between 7% lower to 28 times lower impacts than aluminium, and from 25% to 6 times lower impacts than polypropylene containers. The reason for that is simply that less material is needed for extruded polystyrene than it is for polypropylene, and less energy is used than for aluminium. So that's a no-brainer. Now, if we compare, say, these single-use containers with a reusable Tupperware on the next slide, we see a comparison which looks at the number of uses of reusable polypropylene containers needed to equal the impact of single-use containers. So the first half of the table compares Tupperware with the expanded polystyrene for a number of impacts that I've shown earlier on. So we can see, for example, that we have to reuse Tupperware 18 times before its carbon footprint reduces to be equal to that of extruded polystyrene. For some other impact, the number of reuses is much higher. For resource depletion, it's 208. And then we have a similar comparison for Tupperware and aluminium, where the number of reuses is smaller simply because aluminium container has higher impact. So in summary, and this might come to you as a surprise, single-use, non-recyclable extruded polystyrene has the lowest life cycle environmental impact. Polypropylene is the worst option, and the reusable polypropylene container, the Tupperware, needs to be used from 16 to 208 times to match the single-use EPS container. Now, recycling of EPS is technically possible, and there is some of that going in Japan, but it's very costly. So we see in this example again that circular does not necessarily translate into sustainable, or in this particular case, environmentally sustainable. And again, the debate that we are having and policy is being created on, I would call it emotion, rather than actual facts, because we see that plastics actually has much lower impact than anything else. So I would like to conclude my talk by summarizing and saying that most supply chains are not designed for a circular economy, and there is a lot of work to be done on that. We also still need to understand better when circular is actually sustainable, and what are the trade-offs. To be able to do that, we need to take a systems approach and apply life cycle thinking. I would also say that the implementation of a circular economy will be very challenging, but on a positive note, I also believe it's achievable. First of all, drivers are increasing for that, legislation, some economic drivers as well, but also environmental drivers. Methods and evaluation tools are becoming more available. We have lots of them. We just need to start applying them in the right way and in this context. Circular technologies to enable circularity are developing, albeit a bit slower than we would hope. We also need more success stories to stimulate the uptake. I've shown you some examples on the vacuum cleaners. There are many others in different sectors, and maybe some of the organizations listening to this seminar are already doing it and maybe can share some of those examples. But I would also say that while the free market is a really great idea, I think we do need to legislate this further because otherwise progress in transforming to a circular economy will be a rather slow one. On this note, I would like to acknowledge some of my collaborators who are listed on the next slide. And on this note, I shall stop and take any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Lisa, for a very interesting and stimulating talk. So I don't know, maybe we can start with questions with the audience who's listening out there. Anybody would like to ask a question to Professor Sapajic? Or,
I can ask something.
Yeah. Okay, maybe we'll start here with Professor Gunaris.
Professor Sapajic, thank you very much for your talk. Very interesting. Certainly a lot of the outcomes I would not have guessed. Very unintuitive, and shows why systems approaches are useful in this context. My question wants to take you a little bit in one of your earlier slides where you essentially reference the three pillars of sustainability, finances, environment, and social impact. And for the first two, we have all these methodologies and these standards to guide us through life cycle analysis, but what is the state of the art on trying to quantify social impact of various alternatives? Do we have similar standards?
Yes. Yes, thank you very much for your question. That's a really important one that I guess as engineers and technical people, we tend to focus on economic and environmental impacts more than social aspects. But yes, we do have, although we don't have a standard, we have a guidance or framework methodology, which was developed by the United Nations Environment Program some other organizations a few years ago, which is called Social Life Cycle Assessment, which is a good methodology, but unfortunately it's very complex and complicated, and it involves quantifying about almost 200 different indicators, which has made it quite difficult to apply in practice, because of course you need all of these data and then you have to quantify the indicators and so on. But we are seeing in the literature an increase in social life cycle assessment studies.
Yes, Ben, maybe if you come here in front. So this is Ben Sauk, one of our graduate students. Ben?
So this is maybe a kind of detailed question. Have you looked into usage of straws versus reusable straws? I know that's been a hot debate topic in America recently. that companies like Starbucks and others have started, or California, I think, has started banning straws. Has that been anything you've looked into or considered?
Yes, thank you. That's also a very interesting question. And forgive me, I'm laughing a little bit because when that topic first emerged, I couldn't help but laugh. I'm sorry, I don't think that's going to save the planet looking at the straws. But my first question is, why do we need them in the first instance? You know, it's just something that we have got so accustomed to. We could do without that. So, yeah, I'm not a big fan of looking into is it better to reuse them or not. Simply don't use them.
There's a social impact. needs to be one.
Yeah, sure, but I mean, how would we suffer if we didn't use straw?
Yeah, not really. Okay, let's see any... Yeah, so we have here another question since Pete Parker, so...
I'm just wondering, in each of the kind of problems you looked at, you had a set of like 6 to 8 different impacts that you looked at, and I'm wondering how you chose those impacts for each problem.
Yes, thank you. Actually, typically in life cycle assessment, we consider almost about 20 different impacts. Just for the simplicity and the... For this seminar, I've chosen some illustrative examples of the impacts, but in all other cases, we have in all of these cases, we have estimated a full suite of impacts. And of course, you can choose in life cycle assessment which ones you want to estimate based on the relevance, data availability, and so on. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay, thank you, yeah. Any other questions?
This is Chi from the phone. So I'm kind of wondering, what's the reason why the polypropylene eutrophication impact is so high?
Polypropylene. Sorry, did you say polypropylene? I'm sorry, the line wasn't that good.
Correct. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I'm on a plane. Polypropylene eutrophication.
Polypropylene eutrophication, and this is... when we were looking at the containers, let me just get that.
Correct, yeah.
Yes, it will be to do with, it's within the life cycle of polypropylene, and it will probably have to do with the... either something that's used in the process or maybe associated with energy, because eutrophication is typically associated with nutrients that we emit into the environment. But I don't remember that detail off the top of my head, so I can come back to you on that particular one.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions?
This is Srikant from Dow Chemicals. Yeah. So do we have any genome project like studies that sort of catalogs these kind of sustainable studies for a wide range of consumer products?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question, please?
So we have the Human Genome Project, right, that sort of like tries to sequence the DNA of various organisms and tries to catalog it. So I'm wondering if there's any active open source project out there that tries to catalog such sustainability studies over a wide range of products.
Ah, okay, yeah. Yes, that's a very interesting question. Not of the size of the genome project, but there are very many life cycle assessment studies of very many different products, and some of that is available in the public domain, some of that is available commercially. So I would say probably the greater repository of all of these data is EcoInvent, which you probably will be familiar with, the LCA database. But I don't think we have, I know we don't have one-stop shop with all of the products and impact and so on. One of the difficulties, of course, with different studies being carried out by different people is that the data are different, the assumptions are different, and, you know, the methodologies might differ and so on. But I think you raise a very interesting point and the need to do something like that, particularly as, you know, we are talking more about circular economy and various other transformations of our economies, and we still really don't understand what are the full environmental implications of all of that.
Great. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions out there? Let me ask you one question, Adisa, in the diagram that you had, sort of the circular economy, sort of the worldwide, you sort of show like a supply chain, and supply chain is obviously one of the, you know, topics that is of interest in our group here in enterprise-wide optimization. Can you comment in terms of circular economy whether local manufacturing now will tend to be favored versus, for example, more global trade? Are there any general trends along those lines? Just simply because, I mean, intuitively, I would think global trade, you have, of course, transportation. Transportation obviously incurs also a lot in environmental impact. So any general trends along those lines? I know that of course, it's going to depend on each particular product, but just in general, are we moving more towards local, or are we moving more towards global, or both? Okay.
Yeah, well, from my experience, I think the move is still towards the global production, and mainly, you know, where it's cheaper to produce, although we are now seeing some sort of onshoring, as it's known, for various reasons. In terms of the, you know, is it better to do it locally or globally, as you've suggested, it will really depend on the product. Transportation is often a red herring, I would say. We talk a lot about transport, but per unit of product, often it won't really matter much unless you are transporting lots of water, such as in milk or you know, fruit juices or whatever. For food products in particular, it might be even better for us to import it from countries where products are grown, you know, in season and they don't require much energy or water, than for us growing them domestically in heated greenhouses, etc., etc. So it really all is very variable depending on the type of product. If we are looking at non-food products, well, of course it would help if you eliminate the transport, however little that might contribute. But again, it might depend on the economies of scale, and, you know, if somewhere globally the economies of scale are greater than locally, it may still be better to import that product and so on. I know this doesn't answer your question in absolute terms, but
but I think it is a nice overview, because, as you say, it really depends on the product you're talking about, and again, the need for a systems approach to really reach such a conclusion, right?
So, for example, maybe one more quick question on my end. Professor, in your experience, I guess trying to inform policy, to what extent do these, high fidelity quantitative environmental impact studies, LCA type studies, are being, if you will, used in politics or by politicians, and to what extent do these people use them, rather misuse them, you know, to eventually introduce legislation?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. It's very difficult to get policymakers to listen to academics. I mean, that applies generally, and typically these studies are produced by academics. Sadly, they tend to listen to consultants more, and often those studies are not robust enough, in my opinion. They require lots of evidence, though. They won't act on, you know, single studies or a few studies. They require accumulated evidence, you know, just take climate change, how long it took to act on that. So I would say there isn't enough attention paid to life cycle assessment studies at all. But at the European level, I think we are seeing that change, and now lots of policy is actually underpinned by life cycle thinking, and I think its time is coming.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Denise. On that note, we really want to thank you so much for a very interesting and stimulating seminar. Thank you so much.
Thank you all very much for attending. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, thank you, Denise. We'll be in touch soon. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes. Bye now.